Hello, St. Georgians near and far, in the name of our Lord Jesus Christ. On day 58 of our Year of the Bible adventure, or stroll through Holy Scripture, here in Deuteronomy 20 through 22 today, which are kind of, I don't know, what it kind of seems like is, you know, this is the end for Moses, and he just wants to sort of get everything in there. So it's kind of, when you look at sort of outlines of the Bible, this is usually, this sort of section is like listed as other laws, right? Like other laws, and they're kind of varied. When I first looked at them, I was like, oh boy, this is kind of, well, it's kind of random. It's not quite as random as I thought. There are some principles that organize each collection, but it's also more interesting than I had sort of thought at first. So just to jump in, the beginning part is about going to war, and how you go to war. This isn't how you fight war, not at the beginning, but about going to war. And I just thought it was really interesting. So it's because there are exemptions. Everybody goes to war, but there are exemptions. What are the exemptions? It's kind of interesting. If you're a farmer, you're exempt, which, you know, kind of makes sense, right? Like, you don't want to go win a war and have nothing to eat. Okay, fine. But then also, like, sort of distractions. If you just built a house, you get an exemption because, you know, you're thinking about your house, you want to get back, you kind of want to get things over with as quickly as possible, in a way that might, you know, affect morale. I think that's a lot of it. So you get an exemption if you just built a house. You get an exemption if you were just married, for the same reason. You get like a 1-year exemption if you were just married, because for the same kind of reason. You want to go have your year with your new wife first. Maybe because it's a distraction, maybe because it's important to spend that first year together. I don't know. But I think it's a super interesting. Super interesting exemption that's made there. Sorry, I'm walking the dogs. I'm a little. And then the last one is not given by the priest. The last one is given by the officer of the army and goes, all right, which one of you is not courageous? Which one of you is not brave? You guys can go home too. Now, for us, we might think, yeah, but everybody's going to just take advantage of those things, right? And for us, if we're fighting a war, you know, if we have a draft, you go to Canada, you know, people go to Canada to try to get out of it one way or the other. How do we know that people aren't going to take advantage of that kind of thing? And it sounds like, first of all, this is a law coming down. God's providence is not limited or maybe even affected by the number of troops that the Israelites have. In fact, he says, don't worry about it. How many people you have does not affect how well you're gonna fight. And we're gonna see examples of that later with Gideon, where he faces 120,000 people. He's got 30,000 people there, and he sends some of them away, and then he sends some of them away, and God says, no, you still got too many people, even though you've only got, you know, 30,000, and then it was something like 20,000 against this 130,000 person army, and he gets him down to 300, I believe. For God to say. Anyway, so there are these exemptions, which I think are kind of interesting. Let's see, where else are we? The atonement for an unsolved murder is a really weird one. And all the stuff that I read about it said, this is really weird. And nobody knows. So there's an unsolved murder somewhere. No one has seen it. No one knows anything about it. You figure out where the closest town is. You go to the judges or the elders of the town, and then you come out and you have them come out to a sort of valley with what you need is running water, and you do this weird ceremony with a heifer that's never been yoked before, a heifer that, I mean, a donkey, a a cow that has never been, never done any work, and you slaughter it, and then you wash your hands over it, and then the priests are there, but the priests don't do anything until they pronounce absolution at the end. Now, all the stuff that I read about this said, this is weird. It's not attested anywhere else. We don't know exactly where it came from. And there's a sense that this is some ancient practice that the Israelites have been doing. And so Deuteronomy just maintains it for the time being. The efficacious part is the priest's absolution there at the end. By the first century, but first century CE, this practice is not banned or prohibited, but it's not something that is done anymore. And they say because everybody, there's always somebody who knows something about a murder. I don't know, it's just really interesting. Also showing that maybe it's not terribly important to the Mosaic law or to the Israelites practice. But why do you do this? Why do you do this for an unsolved murder? This is the part that I think does matter. Why do you do this for an unsolved murder? And the idea is that an unsolved murder, by having, you know, for us, we'd be like, oh, it's a mystery, you know, put it in the cold case and maybe something will turn up, and just, you know, we'll have a Dateline special about it at some point or something like that. But remember, this is called Holy Land. And the reason it's called Holy Land is not just because, well, in fact, it's not at all because the Israelites are going to be there. It's Holy Land because God's name is going to reside there. And an unsolved murder, a murder that doesn't have resolution or justice, contaminates, pollutes the land itself, pollutes the land. It's like, remember with Cain and Abel, and God says Abel's blood is crying out to me from the ground, right? So it's so the absolution that the priest does is to assuage the contamination or to neutralize the contamination of the land itself. And so that's the process that's being done here. The land itself is being restored to the way it should be, which is, I don't know, it's an interesting sort of insight into the way that they thought about the land, or I should say the way that God thought about the land. There's also this one that is, you know, then there's this one about marrying a captive woman. Now, yeah, I have to say, it got to this one. It was like, oh boy, this is not. I don't feel good about this at all. So if the Israelites, you know, take over a city or take over a place or something, not a Canaanite place, right? Not one with the Hittites or the Jebusites or whatever it is, but I don't know, some other one. Then you see a woman there that you find attractive, and I was like, again, I was like, oh boy, here we go. You're allowed to marry her. I was like, oh great, here we go. But it's interesting the restrictions that are put here, restrictions that are intended to protect the rights and protect the dignity of the captive woman, right, of the woman. So you come, because they're there to actually discourage that practice. So if you bring a captive woman home, and it just sort of assumes that that's a thing that could happen, right? So it doesn't sort of prohibit it outright, which we might prefer. So it just has some like realistic view of like that's how it's going to be. If you bring them home, first of all, you bring them home, and they cut their hair and pare their nails. Now, why is that? Different hypotheses. One is that it's to show that it's starting over, right? But another sort of hypothesis of why that would be is to make them less attractive. So if you're going to bring a captive woman home from out in battle, understand that, first of all, they're going to lose their hair and their nails. Now, you know, is that, I don't know, but that's one of the ideas there. The other is that it's starting over, which is a little bit more, I don't know, normal or something. That they're sort of being sort of born again, as an Israelite. But even then, you still have to wait a month. They still have to be afforded a month, which is a traditional mourning period, to mourn their families, right, that they're not going to see again, or their land that they're not going to see again. But they have to have this month-long period that is where they cannot, how shall we say, their relationship cannot be consummated. Okay, so interesting, right? You have to respect their dignity, and let them do this thing that's sort of natural to do, which is to mourn what they have lost. You can't just go into them right away. The other thing is that it says, and if she no longer pleases you, right? Which could be for any number of reasons. It could be because she doesn't want to be an Israelite, right? And whatever. Or let's say, you know, some young man does this and his affections go. You can't just set her aside. You're not allowed to. Like once you're married, whether it's a foreign woman or an Israelite cousin or anything like that. Once you're married and you have obligations and responsibilities there. And so this woman that you've married, maybe she is from someplace else. You can't just cast aside like she's nothing. You can't sell her. Which I guess was a thing, which I guess is another slavery sort of reference there. You can't do it. You have an obligation. You have an obligation. And if she wants to leave, you can let her go where she wants to go. So that's sort of an interesting. So marrying captive women, okay. But then there are these sort of regulations that perhaps make it a little less attractive and maybe discourages the practice a bit. Interesting, right? The right of the first part, I mean, what we're seeing is justice here. We're seeing these sort of regulations about justice. The right of the firstborn. So again, it assumes that the firstborn has certain rights. This is widely known, right? Throughout the ancient Near East, all over the place, right of the firstborn. We might say, why should the firstborn get rights? That's a genetic, you know, probability, whatever. It is what it is. And he says, okay, but if you have rights of the given that we have rights of the firstborn, it has to be the firstborn. It can't be, you can't just choose your favorite kid, right? And give the double portion to them. It has to be, in particular here, they're saying, let's say you've got a couple wives. You can't give it to the firstborn son of your favorite wife. It has to be the firstborn son that is, you know, actually the firstborn son, sort of protecting those rights. And to a certain point, perhaps protecting the rights of the mother of that child. Again, kind of interesting. Now, this rebellious son literally took my breath away. I was like, how's this going to go? So if you're a parent and you've got a son who is a glutton and a drunkard and you just can't deal with him anymore. Do you remember hearing about those like safe harbor laws or whatever, where they have a sign at Lincoln-Aw, if you have a baby and you can't take care of it, him or her, you can sort of leave them at Lincoln-Aw and Lincoln-Aw will take care of it. And what happened, or like at a police station, they had that too. And you remember that they had, I don't know if you remember this, they had situations where people were trying to drop off 14-year-olds because they couldn't deal with them. Anyway, this is that kind of situation. And you take them to the city gates, which is where the judges are and where the elders are. And you take them to the elders, and the elders determine if they are rebellious or not. And if they are gluttons and drunkards and sort of irredeemable, then the elders. And if the elders find that they are indeed rebellious and irredeemable, then the elders stone them to death there. And I have to say, so I was reading this along, and I was like, how's this going to end? And it says, and then the elders stone them to death. And I literally went, whoa, that was a little surprising to me. I didn't know that that was where that was going to end. And was kind of horrified. As someone who was a rebellious child, around the years of 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, that was kind of something shocking to me. Apparently, the absolute rights of the parent are being mitigated here. And the absolute rights of the parent over the child was a common practice with the Israelites and in the ancient Near East generally. And there are scriptural places where you can see that. If a father wanted to kill a son, right, or ignore a son, now we have like child welfare laws and that kind of thing. They did not have child welfare laws. The father in particular had absolute rights of life and death over a son, not just a baby, right, who they could, like the Romans could leave out on the mountains to leave them to die. But even later, and this is a mitigation of that. This is a compromise of that. It can't be, if you have a rebellious son that you want to kill, because they're irredeemable and, I don't know, bringing dishonor in your family and all this kind of stuff. You can't just sort of vigilante justice. Well, it wouldn't have been considered vigilante justice. But you can't just punish them in that way. First of all, both the father and the mother have to go to the, right? So they have to both agree. The second of all, they can't do it themselves. They have to go to the elders. And the elders have to make a judgment as to whether the father and mother are right or not. Or if they've, you know, got to wait and see how things go or something like that. So they don't get to just make the decisions themselves. Then, sort of to like make it, you know, sort of one more step, it's the elders that have to do the stoning. And, you know, no, I mean, people don't want to do that, you know. Like, unless you're like super sure about it, that killing of that kid could very well be something that is, you know, the blood is on your hands. And so there's one more sort of compromise of paternal and here even parental authority and sort of right of life and death over the kids. You see what I mean? Like there's more and more distance. How about this? More and more distance is being put between the father's temper and the life of the kid. Now, later on in the Talmud, there's a lot of discussion about this. Like, this seemed it seems crazy to us. It seemed a little bit crazy to them too. And so there's talk about it. And one of the things is that one of the things people said is this is mostly a sort of warning, right? This, you know, it's intended as a preventative. And later on, the Talmud would, the rabbis would put so much strictures on this practice, on how they judged if the kid was truly rebellious in an irredeemable way, that it was basically impossible to do. And I read some of them, and they're really, I mean, they're kind of funny, especially once you, so they can't just be like eating and drinking alone. They have to be with a group. They can't just be with a group, a mixed group. There has to be not one honorable person within that group. It can't be sort of one kind of alcohol. It has to be this other kind of alcohol. The parents have to be, the parents can't be deaf or blind or maimed or something like that. Like, very, very specific things in a way that makes it seem like perhaps it was just a warning, something that parents could threaten their kids with, but actually it was very rarely used. Again, sort of an interesting insight into Israelite culture and sort of the ways that the legal system of Israel, which we have a tendency to see as, again, legalistic, right, and a bit punitive, was actually some mitigation of, well, we might say some mitigation of cruelty, rather than cruelty itself, a kind of mitigation of cruelty. I promise I won't go on much longer, but you can't leave out in 21, at the end of chapter 21, about the capital offense is put to death on a pole. Because the word pole there is tree. They obviously didn't have any poles like flag poles made out of metal. they had wooden trees. I mean, they had trees, which are obviously made out of wood. Now this, obviously, okay, and like, what do? You put them to death on a pole, but you have to make sure that they're buried that same day. Again, to keep them out of the, keep their contamination sort of way. You have to bury them the same day. And it says they are cursed by God. They're not cursed. They don't bear God's curse because they've been killed and hung on a pole. They're hung on a pole because they are bearing God's curse. And so you want them in the ground and out of the way and that kind of thing. This is what is picked up in discussions of, in New Testament discussions of the crucifixion of Jesus. He was hung on a tree. And Peter says this to the crowd. Or is it Paul? Somebody says it to the crowd. Oh man, this is the thing I should know. The Messiah you put to death by hanging him on a tree. Was he cursed by God? He bore the curses that we all should have. He bore them, and so he was hung, on a tree, which is the tree of the cross. So it was interesting. The Christian commentaries that I read about this, of course, went on and on about it to great degree. Jewish commentaries obviously had nothing to say about it. Had more to say about how you either hang someone on the pole, or do you impale them on a pole, or that kind of thing. But you can see why the early church, which knows Deuteronomy backwards and forwards, Jesus knew Deuteronomy backwards and forwards, we'll see later Jesus' death as sort of an example of this, his atoning death as an example of this, that it's not just that he was killed unfairly. That's not an unusual thing, but rather the death itself took away the curse that everybody else had. This is what's called substitutionary atonement. Some people like it, some people don't, but there you are. Here's one of the places that you sort of see it, or see why it's there. Now, remember, where did they get this analysis? Remember that when, after Jesus' resurrection, he's walking to Emmaus. Some of the disciples are walking to Emmaus, and they're all very sad about Jesus dying. And it said he opened their minds to understanding the scriptures, starting with Moses, right? So most likely he started with both the story of Moses. I mean, like the Exodus. I mean, I don't know what he started with, but you can understand why it would start with that. But then also these laws. I mean, very, very well it might have been. Remember the thing about hung on the pole? Well, the Lord took, you know, this guy Jesus that you're talking about, that you're mourning, took away that curse. It was without sin. You saw him. Anyway, there it is. Whenever we come across the stuff that is sort of directly referred to in the New Testament, and we're not reading about sort of these random laws, some of which we understand, some of which we don't, I always go, yay, that's great. Because there is some sort of like weird stuff later, mostly that have to do with keeping separate things separate. the seeds, what else is it? Like wearing the linen and the wool together. You can't wear the linen and the wool together. People aren't sure why that is. But given the context where it is, it seems like in general, it's that has to do with sort of maintaining the order that God made. Just want to make one note about the thing about men wearing women's clothing and women's wearing men's clothing. We said, aha, this is some comment about being transvestite or transgender, something like that. No, they don't have any examples of that. So there's two explanations. Nobody says anything about it. Nobody says anything along those lines in the early commentaries. That's not what they're worried about. There's two possible explanations that are usually offered traditionally. And when I say traditionally, I don't mean like 100 years ago. I mean, you know, 3,000 years ago, not 3,000, but 2,500 years ago, when you can't blame them for being woke or something like that. One of them is that sort of dressing as someone of the opposite sex only happened in pagan religious ceremonies. So again, it's a warning against sort of compromising Israelite worship with this other kind of worship that you would find around in Canaan. Don't do that, right? The other is, again, maintaining the order that it would be used for deception, right? That a man would either avoid some kind of consequences or, you know, avoid some kind of responsibility or, I don't know, get up to no good by just sort of trying to disguise himself as someone else, and, you know, or vice versa. And that's why. So, when I first read it, I was like, oh, is this a culture war? Am I in the, you know, 8th century BC culture war? Probably not. Nobody talks anything about that, until sort of the modern age. And when I say modern, I do mean the last 50-100 years. Less 100, more like 50. Anyway, I've gone on and on. Marriage violation. I'm going to leave all that stuff aside. It's going to get... I'm just going to leave it there. There's a bunch of sex stuff, but I've gone long enough, and I don't really want to talk about it anyway. So it's a Friday. I'm supposed to be off. I don't know. There we go. All right. I'll leave that there. Leave it there and wait for tomorrow. But let's first pray. Oh God, who has caused all holy scriptures, even the weird ones, to be written for our learning, grant that we may in such wise hear them, read, mark, learn, and inwardly digest them, that by patience and comfort of thy holy word, we may embrace and ever hold fast the blessed hope of everlasting life, which thou hast given us in Jesus Christ our Lord. Amen. All right, happy reading. I hope that you can hang in there with some of this stuff. It's actually pretty cool. I mean, some of it isn't, but sort of understanding where it comes from and having it be an insight into Israelite society and what it's like and God's ethics and everything. It's interesting. Anyway, all right, onwards and upwards. Talk to you tomorrow.